Hi, this is Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How Even the Small Things Can Have Big Rewards, A Quick Look at Your Environmental Impact. It's with Nell Newman. Nell Newman is probably best known for having a very famous daddy, Paul Newman. Her mother was Joan Woodward, but she says the biggest lessons she learned from them had nothing to do with Hollywood. They gave her a love of food, environment, philanthropy, and the knowledge that even the little things you do in life can have a huge impact, even if no one sees you doing them. That's why, even though it can seem overwhelming at first to think about, Nell says it's important to take a quick inventory of your life and be mindful of how you affect everything around you, from what you buy to what you throw away. But those steps can be simple and small, and in this audio interview, you'll hear how to get started. You'll also hear why Paul Newman was so driven to give back, why he usually kept this under wraps, and some of the many ways he secretly did it. You'll hear the real difference between USDA certified organic and farm grown organic, and why it's extra important to give your money directly to the local farmers if you can. You'll hear about a little known humble story of how Paul Newman started his salad dressing company. You'll hear five little areas of life you can take notice of that will contribute big when it comes to the environment. You'll also hear all about the double value food stamp program you've probably never heard of and the truth behind why you've probably never heard about it. When it comes to making a difference in this world, Nell says every little bit counts. Big ideas usually start out small, and so do impactful people. And in this audio interview, you'll hear how you can start small and contribute big, too.
Hi, this is Chris Costello, and I've teamed up with Michael Senoff to bring you the world's best health-related interviews. So if you know anyone struggling with their weight, with cancer, diabetes, ADHD, autism, heart disease, or other health issues, send them over to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Today we are talking with Nell Newman. Nell, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you have got quite an interesting story. One of the most interesting things, besides being the daughter of famous celebrities, is when you were studying in school, you got a degree in human ecology. What is human ecology?
Human ecology has probably become a little bit more refined in its definition, but basically it's sort of an interdisciplinary study that looks at how humans relate to their environment in terms of the social and the natural mission of our place on the planet. And I went to College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine, and that was the only degree that was offered by College of the Atlantic. And it fit me to a T, so I'm really glad I went there. It was a wonderful little tiny college. I'm really glad that that's the spot I chose.
And how do you think that early interest in ecology, and how did that all get started for you?
I grew up in Connecticut in Westport back when it was very rural, and basically my backyard was the woods and the river that ran through it, and we had a pack of dogs, and I ran around the woods and fished. And so I was a budding biologist at a young age. It was always being outdoors and being immersed in nature was really the way I grew up. That was my education. My education process was living outside and observing nature and observing birds. I was fascinated by birds. I was a budding ornithologist and mesmerized by the fact that they could fly and I couldn't. And I found it extremely frustrating and discovered that my favorite bird of prey, the peregrine falcon, was extinct east of the Mississippi. You know, I was probably about 9 or 10, and, you know, I'd read about extinction because I'd read books on different species of animals that had gone extinct prior to my life, the dodo bird and the passenger pigeon. We managed to eat them all, but this was unique in the fact that it was an effect of mankind on an animal, something I hadn't really explored before at age 9 or 10, which was, you know, they'd gone extinct east of the Mississippi due to the use of a pesticide called DDT that was sprayed on plants to kill bugs and had worked its way up through the food chain. To me, that was really a mystery and a horrifying thought that there was something that we were spraying on our food that could kill off the fastest bird in the sky. That was really how I was indoctrinated at a young age, and that was my early interest.
Now, one of the books you wrote is the Newman's Own Organic Guide to the Good Life, Simple Measures That Benefit You and the Place You Live. And tell us a little about that book.
This is sort of a joint effort between myself, my business partner, Pete, a wonderful editor, who used to be at Random House, Mary Barr, and a group of us who sat down and really tried to spell out the simple ways that you can make changes in your life. Because, you know, nobody's perfect, and it is overwhelming. And it's important to remember that every little thing that you do does have an effect. My mom really taught me that. So we just decided to put down some easy recommendations and some guidelines. It's a little old now. I mean, some of the information's dated. We'd love to do a new one. But it is still sort of the basis of how does one make a change and what changes can you make that are worthwhile. So I think it's still a good guide. My overall perspective is really just being mindful about what your impact is, which is certainly what my human ecology degree was based on a daily basis when you go through your life, to really be mindful about what you buy, what it's wrapped in. Can you make that trip on your bicycle? Just all of those little things in our consumeristic world. How does one really make mindful choices about what you need on a daily basis and whatever ways you can use to reduce your waste stream? So I think it's more of a overall perspective than certainly specific examples. But, you know, overall, how can you be mindful about your consumption? Because think about what would happen if you didn't have a garbage can. You know, where would stuff go? Could you compost it? Can you compost your paper bags? I mean, it's more of a mental state than specific guidelines.
We did find a quote that I just love in Success Magazine from you, and you said, "I want our company to leave a legacy of learning to find the balance between what's good and what's good for you. What's good? Supporting local farmers, making purchases based on need versus want, voting with your dollars. These are big ideas, starting companies, charitable giving, organic farming, helping communities. But big ideas begin small. They start with an individual with a generous spirit and a willingness to care, something that anyone can cultivate."
Thank you for reading it.
Yeah, and your dad, Paul Newman, started Newman's Organics. How did that all get started?
It was one of those funny things. Dad always made his own salad dressing, and that salad dressing was based on a recipe he got from a little restaurant in New York called Madame Romaine de Lyons, which unfortunately is no longer in existence. And she made a very assertive olive oil and red wine vinegar dressing. And he loved that dressing, and he made it for us, and he made it every night for dinner. And he used to give it away in wine bottles to friends at Christmas, and people got so enamored of it that they would bring their wine bottle back and want to get it refilled. And so it became sort of a running joke. And we should really produce this. It would be less time consuming to do it commercially. So he finally decided to look into it. And when he looked into it, he discovered, you know, it was a big ordeal. And I think the first person he talked to about it, a manufacturer, said, you know, "The problem, Paul, is that celebrity products always fail." And he really took that as a challenge. He found a manufacturer who would produce it, and then he found a grocery store chain, which at the time was, I think, one store, and that was Stu Leonard's in Connecticut, in Westport. And Stu Leonard's agreed to take the whole first run of product, which was, I think, 30,000 cases. And the first year he had sold hotcakes, and the first year he had $850,000, and he decided that he was going to give it all away because he felt guilty sticking it in his pocket. And so that was really the way that Newman's Own started. You know, he was a very humble man, and he didn't really care if anybody knew that he was going to give the money away. So it took a couple of years before he actually put anything on the label. And I used to chide him about it and say, "Hey, you know, you'd sell more product if people knew that you gave the money away." He grumbled about it, and he said, "Well, you know, that's not really the reason I'm doing it." And he had a bunch of excuses. And then the next year, in the smallest print on the bottle, it said, "All profits to charity." So that was the way it went. It really was a small part of what he thought was important. He wasn't doing it for recognition. He was just doing it for all those right reasons, which is selflessly.
And how did your dad pick the charities?
I'm not sure how he did it in the early years. He wasn't really vocal about it with me, but he always had a desire to help the underdogs. You know, he really wanted to help small organizations who had a tough time raising money. And that was really what he liked funding. So that was sort of the genesis of how he got going.
Where do you think that developed from?
I'm not sure. You know, I think he always considered himself very lucky, that he used to joke, if he'd been born in another country, what would have happened? He never would have had that career. He used to joke, if he'd been born with brown eyes, what would have happened? He used to just say that it was all based on luck. He was lucky to be born in the United States, and it was luck that led him to being a famous actor, and therefore he felt really driven to give something back. So I think that just was part of his DNA, really.
when you saw how Newman's Own was obviously going to be a success and something certainly with a lot of heart involved, did you get interested right away, or how did that all evolve?
I always had recommendations for him when he was doing product formulation, just because I was a family cook. So my mom and dad taught me how to cook. And basically, he always asked me about different ideas, and they're going to make a salsa, and what do you think? So I was around for all the taste testing and just tried to help out however I could. I was fascinated by what he was doing, and it just seemed like such a novel way to provide money for charity. And when I moved out to California after I graduated from College of the Atlantic, I was amazed to see how much organic was available in California compared to Maine. There wasn't really any organic in Maine, not that I could find, certainly not in the grocery store. And so I remember talking to Pop and saying, you know, there's just amazing amount of organic produce out here. They had a Wednesday market when I first arrived that probably had 30 farmers and 75% of it was organic. And, you know, Maine, that's really from one extreme to another. I mean, Maine has a short growing season and there's some interesting stuff grown there, but not a lot of it. And going to Central California in the middle of the salad belt was certainly a big contrast. So I just became intrigued while I was trying to fundraise and be the executive director of this small nonprofit called the Ventana Wilderness Sanctuary and the Predatory Bird Research Group. I worked for both of them at one time or another, that maybe there was a better way to do this to raise money. And maybe I should really try and find some format like what Dad had, but do it a little differently, which I guess was sort of a triple bottom line concept. You know, support the growth of organic agriculture and at the same time provide money for charity and supporting the environment. That was the basis of our early thoughts on Newman's Own Organic.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. And so did that start off a whole learning process for you as far as organics, or had you already had that kind of knowledge base?
At the time, I knew a little bit. I knew, in theory, what organic was. I had absolutely no experience in the world of organic food manufacturing, so it did require a big learning curve. And thankfully, my father thought that it was worthwhile. You know, when you think about it, it was a big gesture on his part to be so supportive. So he said, look, I'll pay you guys, my business partner, Peter Meehan, and I, to go off and educate yourselves about this for 1 year. And the deal was he would pay each of us $15,000, and we would have to pay him back for all the startup costs. So basically, he was floating us the money, really. We spent a year going around to the natural product shows and just trying to educate ourselves about the process, how things were done and different products and what were the trends. And it was pretty successful. I mean, that's how we came up with the idea for pretzels.
And it's wildly successful now. And does a lot of the revenue still go towards charities?
We have a royalty that we pay to the foundation for the use of Dad's name. It's been like that since we became independent. So we're very proud to be a part of the continuing philanthropy at the Newman's Own Foundation.
And I imagine you're all over the world at this point?
No, actually. I know when I travel, I occasionally see products. Like, I see products in Mexico. I have no idea how they get there. Newman's Own has products all over the world, but we really are still trying to saturate the United States. Our products are more expensive because organic ingredients are more expensive. So it's tougher to ship organic products internationally. It makes much more sense to make things like that when you're there.
But the trend is certainly going towards organics, at least in the United States.
Yes.
Now, what is the difference between, say, like USDA organics and your local farm-grown organics?
There may be nothing. I think it's under $20,000 or $30,000. If they have a very small sales, they don't have to get certified. But it's no hormones. No antibiotics, no artificial fertilizers, no pesticides. That's the way things have to be grown for at least 3 years before they can be certified organic. That's the broad definition. Then when you're processing a product, that definition is maintained all the way through the processing of a product into a cookie, say, or a piece of chocolate. And there can be no cross-contamination of a conventional product with an organic product. So all the way through the manufacturing, everything has to be kept separated. Everything has to be cleaned down in advance. There are very specific guidelines to how this can be made. It's not rocket science, really. It's basically the way, as I read in an ad just recently, you know, before 1945, everything was organic.
That was my next question. Do you ever envision a world where we're actually back to it's normal to have food that doesn't have pesticides in it?
I do imagine it. The biggest stumbling block is, and it has been increasing, until there's equal funding for organic research as there is for conventional research. Equal funding over equal time, we'll know what the broader, larger implications of organic agriculture is for the planet. We can already D.C., there are certainly examples. The Rodale Institute has been doing studies for 20-plus years on the yields of organic versus conventional. And I think it's been very profound. Basically, when the soil is restored from a conventional state to a rich, full of nutrients state, they can get equal yields to conventional agriculture. And during times of drought, they actually get higher yields. So there are examples. Different crops certainly have different rates of production, but it's basically giving farmers the tools to be able to plant accordingly and see how this works for them. But conventional agriculture's got a lot more money in it than organic does.
So basically, if a product is labeled organic, you can pretty much be confident it really is organic?
I do, and I think that probably the bigger question is, if it's not labeled organic, what is it? We had the Good Food Awards up here in San Francisco, which was started by Alice Waters, and this was their first year. And it's looking at small producers all over the United States who produce sustainable products. They had charcuterie, chocolate, coffee, jams. I got to do the jam judging, cheeses. It was a wonderful, wonderful project to work on. It was just fascinating. And one of the farmers that I was talking to, who was a small farmer, was saying about how expensive it was to get certified for a small farmer. When you look at the difference between organic and conventional, organic guys are trying to prove that they didn't put anything on their plant. You know, they're paying a lot of money to certify that they're doing it the old-fashioned way, which somehow seems ass backwards to me. It just does when you think about it. They're the ones working hard, and it is more labor-intensive. And people do it because they have a love of the land, and they are trying to work in harmony with nature rather than against nature. Somehow it seems like the certification should be on the other foot.
And so do a lot of people that grow locally, are they actually organic, but they just haven't done the certification?
Absolutely. And you have to really talk to the farmers you're buying from at the farmers market. A lot of them are too small to get certified. And a lot of them, because of some of the issues we've just been discussing, they feel that they're not going to get certified. They have ethical rationale for why they're not doing it, because they don't believe they have to. They don't want to have to pay the extra money, and this is the way they've been doing it for generations. You will see a lot of signs at a farmer's market that say, sustainably grown. You do have to ask and see how people really are growing things. That's part of the fun of going to a farmer's market, talking to farmers about how they grow their food. The best part is the money goes right to the farmer. You're supporting your local sustainable economies. You've got a smaller food footprint, hopefully, if it really is truly local food. It's fresher. I mean, there's nothing like buying something that was picked that day. I mean, you just don't find that in the store, not very often. We're a little spoiled out here in California, but when I go back east, all the lettuce is from here. Unfortunately, I don't know why they don't grow lettuce on the East Coast, but very rarely do you find lettuce that's grown locally. Sometimes they're just sort of coming on with that now. There's so many reasons. I find giving my money directly to the farmer is very important, and buying things that are so fresh. I mean, it just makes such a difference to the taste and the nutrition and your local environment. That's what you're supporting.
And the studies are pretty remarkable. I mean, the organic foods and the foods grown in your own garden are so superior as far as the nutrition. Our food now that we get in our supermarkets that's shipped all over the planet, it's remarkable how much nutritional benefit has been lost.
In the process of shipping. I know. I think that that's true. And I think that it makes sense when you think about how things are grown. And if you're never putting back into the soil, if you're never adding true amendments to the soil, you're not adding compost, nutrients, you're not building your soil, but you look at conventional production, that's not how they do it. They're spraying chemicals on it. I don't know how anything thrives in that soil. And then, well, what comes out of it? They may have the proper nutrients that were put in a mineral form, but it's not building the soil and supporting all the microorganisms that normally help produce those nutrients for a plant. It's a very different form of production. This article I just read, I can't remember the numbers, is 200 some odd man-made chemicals that they tested for in pregnant mothers. And I think they found 100 and some different types of chemicals in their bodies. The chemical industry put out a statement saying that these were all very small quantities and none of them are known to have any health effects. And to a certain extent, I suppose that's true, but what really has not been looked at thoroughly is the synergistic effects of what happens when you take 165 different man-made chemicals and combine it in a human body. And where do those chemicals come from? Obviously, they come from the air. They come from your house if you're spraying things in your house, but they're probably largely coming through your food and or your water. So the synergistic effects are certainly unknown, and that statement seems to be a loophole as to we know that these chemicals are safe in small doses. But I think you really have to look at the big picture. And the big picture is this a sustainable method of farming? And really, there's not a tremendous indication at this point that things like genetic engineering, you know, we don't have any drought tolerance. We don't have any increased nutrition. All we really have at this point is cross-contamination to organic food crops, which is against the regulations for the production of. It's a huge problem if you're an organic farmer and you're growing organic corn and your neighbor's growing genetically engineered corn.
Is it happening really frequently?
It really depends on there aren't that many genetically engineered crops that have been released that are also grown organically. That's where you have the problem. There are a lot of battles going on right now with Center for Food Safety and the USDA over allowing genetically engineered crops to be planted without doing the proper environmental impact report. So in the cases where you're growing chard and somebody next to you is growing genetically engineered beet, there can be cross-contamination there. And it's really bad with corn. So it's very tough to do organic corn. It's an unintended consequence, but it's falling on the shoulders of the organic farmer.
This couple of groups also that you're involved in, one is the Wholesome Wave Foundation.
Wholesome Wave is a wonderful organization which has been really trying to look at the issue of nutrition and access to nutritious food. And so they've been doing a double value food stamp program at farmers markets across the United States. They work with a nonprofit arm in the state to help get these programs out so that if you're on food stamps, you can double the value of your food stamps when you are actually at the farmers market. And it promotes the usage of food stamps at farmers market. It's quite a remarkable program. And they've had tremendous success and growth in the use of food stamps at farmers markets due to this, because people do want to improve their food consumption. And so this is one way to do it.
This is Chris Costello reporting for Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. And then the other one is Allergy Kids.
Allergy Kids was started by Robin O'Brien to really educate the public and moms about some of the effects of different allergens in foods and food contamination. You know, what's in your food? Basically, the whole concept between organics and genetically engineered crops, and really trying to look at the research behind how are these engineered food products and man-made chemicals affecting children. She has a wonderful organization.
If people want to find out more about Newman's Own Organics, where can they go?
We have a website. It's newmansownorganics.com. All natural food stores have our products, and you can find out what products are available by looking at our website. We usually do coupons on our website also.
So, Nell, what do you think are some of the gifts that your father, Paul Newman, and your mother, Joanne Woodward, gave to you?
First and foremost, they really taught me a true love of food and interest in food and family. We always ate family meals together. Both my parents cooked, and Pop and I used to always go to the farm stand. My dad actually taught me how to pick fresh produce. You know, what does a ripe melon smell like? You know, how do you pick a good watermelon? What does it sound like? I mean, he was very involved in cooking in our family, and I think that was something that I really find very precious. And my mom was the same way. We had old apple trees in our backyard, and that's where we got apples for pies and applesauce. And she let me get chickens and taught me how to garden. And it really carried through the rest of my life and gave me a tremendous interest in food and family over my whole life. I learned a tremendous amount about food through them. And in terms of philanthropy, they certainly taught through example. They were both very generous and very humble about their lives and what they did with their lives. As you know, they were not very vocal about what they did, but I think that they set a very good example.
I read a quote from your dad that he had a dream that he went to some kind of awards or a speech, something he had to give, and they said to him, you know, how dare you ride in on the coattails of your wife? Had you heard that one?
No, I hadn't. That's great.
It's really pretty charming. Now, you also had an acting career, right?
I did two movies when I was little and one documentary. The documentary was called The Eagle and the Hawk. I think it was actually produced by Audubon. And it was a little documentary about my friend Morley Nelson, who was a World War II ski trooper and a falconer who taught me about falconry. Very instrumental in my education. And basically trying to educate the public about shooting birds of prey or not shooting birds of prey, what was going on in Idaho and across the West. It was very successful in reducing the amount of birds that were brought in shot. And the other two were The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon Marigold, which was a famous play that my dad made into a movie. And then the other one was Rachel, Rachel. Both were directed by my father, and my mother was in them. So that was my brief foray that ended at age 13.
It just didn't click for you?
No, it didn't. I always wanted to be a biologist. I had no interest in acting after that.
You know, if there's people out there listening that they're trying to figure out what to do or just have questions about what they can do to make it a better environment, what would you say to them?
You know, there are a lot of people doing a lot of good work these days. I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting nonprofits, the ones that I mentioned today. I think the most important thing people can do is educate themselves. Pick a topic that intrigues you and dive into it. I mean, that's what I did as a kid, and it really served me well. I mean, something that you're passionate about is something that you're willing to take the time and learn about, and I think that that's probably the most important thing you can do is to educate yourself about the topics that you're interested in and see how you can make a change. Because, as my mother said, every little bit counts. And I think that's the most important thing you can do.
Just once again, we want to thank you so much, Nell, for joining us and look forward to seeing what you're up to in the future.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's the end of our interview. I hope you've enjoyed it. For more great interviews like this, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.